This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thanks so much, Auntie Joy, for putting your personal story about Barak into context. Our next speaker is Carol Cooper, who's had a long-standing interest in Aboriginal art of the 19th century, and Carol is currently the Senior Curatorial Fellow here at the National Museum. Please welcome Carol.
Thanks, everyone. I've got to sort of get myself together a bit. Thanks very much, Helen. And it's very hard to follow from Auntie Joy, but I'm really glad I am following because she said lots of things and introduced lots of ideas that I can draw on in my talk. I would also like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people and their elders past and present. And today, our very special guest, Auntie Joy Wanda Murphy, herself a great communicator, descendant of William Barak and member of the Wurundjeri people. Quick change of glasses here. Joy is Barak's great-great-niece, as we know, and she's kindly supported and encouraged my own research into Barak's art in a joint publication that we wrote with Judith Ryan in 2003 for the Remembering Barak exhibition at the National Gallery of Victoria. Joy concluded her essay entitled Barak, My Uncle, with the words, and I love these words, that's why I'm getting to read them, "Thank you, Uncle, for keeping the fire burning and keeping our culture alive. Your paintings are ancient treasures. In the modern world, you remind us of our place of belonging." Oh, help, I haven't got Barak on screen. I need Jonathan as well, I think. But is this the one? It's a strange thing. This painting of Barak, made when he was approximately 60 years old, is a very fine one and always reminds me of Anne Bond's beautiful description of Barak. Bond said, quote, "He might be termed one of nature's gentlemen. He possessed an intellectual head covered with beautiful wavy hair, a kindly intellectual face with fine features and piercing black eyes. His countenance was very attractive and radiated by his pleasant smile and merry laugh." It's good that Bon, a close and lifelong supporter of Barak and of Corranderk Station, records this memory of Barak's merry laugh, because he did in many ways have such a sad life. And I think I always think when I read that, I thought of Auntie Joy, actually, because she has a very merry laugh. And it's good that we're here today to celebrate both Barak and the other Aboriginal artists of the southeast, and to also acknowledge the great work that Andrew has done in drawing the attention of everyone to these great artists. Wrong way. I remember, as though it was only yesterday, although it was 20 years ago, how amazing and exciting it was to walk into the National Gallery of Australia in 1994 and see a wall of Barak drawings. While it's wonderful to have this black and white photograph, courtesy of Andrew, and thank you very much, Andrew, for sending me this, it doesn't do justice to my memory of the colour of that wall. To the incredible movement and colour of the Barak drawings. As Judith Ryan from the National Gallery of Victoria has commented, Barak's drawings present a very powerful feeling of being, quote, inside an event from an inclusive Wurundjeri perspective. This strong feeling comes from seeing one of Barak's drawings, so it was an incredible privilege and joy to see so many of his original works together. This was the first time that I remember thinking that even though in general the works were often similar in content, with the arrays of cloaked and dancing tribesmen, seated women making music, displays of native animals and wooden weapons, they were also all very different. And this can be seen, I think, in looking closely at these three drawings now held in museums in Germany, similar in their content but no doubt recounting very different stories. And I think it was just an amazing... I know it was an amazing amount of work that Andrew did in curating the 1994 exhibition. And those of us who were lucky enough really to see it in Canberra, but also to see it down in Melbourne as well, were indeed very privileged, because to see all of those works amassed together was a huge job, a huge treat, and something I don't know when that will happen again. So that was very good. William Barak was extraordinarily knowledgeable about his culture, and he was also a gifted communicator, a Narangita, or headman, and a leader of his people. Early in his major written work, The Native Tribes of Southeast Australia, when he first introduces Barak, Howitt says that he, quote, was an extraordinary repository of information as to his tribe. And although his name is not listed in the index, Howitt quotes Barak directly at least 35 times in the book, and often he includes a transcription of the phrase used by Barak in his Wawurrung language. Barak's name and knowledge is also very frequently called upon in the earlier papers that Howitt published, and it is obvious that his conversations with Barak were one of his major sources for, in fact, his primary source for Aboriginal culture. I don't have time here to more than briefly sketch Barak's relationships to Howitt, but I would like to acknowledge the work of both John Mulvaney and the late Diana Barwick for much of the background I use, as well as Isabel McBride for her study of the Mount William axe quarries. As you can see, Barak and Howitt were roughly contemporary, and they both lived into their late 70s. Barak was a young boy, by his own reckoning, about 11 or 12, when his world was changed dramatically by the incursion of explorers and graziers into his tribal lands of the Port Phillip in 1835. His father, Babajan, was one of the headmen of the Wurundjeri clan, of the Wurundjeri, a clan of the Wurrung language and larger Kulin nation. The public servant, explorer and amateur anthropologist A.W. Howitt lived in Gippsland, Victoria, and talked extensively with many of the Aboriginal elders on the missions and settlements with whom he actively sought connection. I'm going to cut out a little bit of information there. In the early 1840s, the situation for Aboriginal people in Victoria was fairly desperate. In his 1880 publication, Camilleroy and Kearney, Howitt described the advancement of European settlement as being, quote, marked by a line of blood, and surviving groups were also badly affected by lack of food and susceptibility to diseases. The Port Phillip Protectorate was abolished in 1849, but Protector William Thomas was retained as a court interpreter and guardian for the local Aboriginal people of the Melbourne area. From 1860, Barak became associated with the Corranderk Aboriginal Reserve, situated on Badger Creek near the Yarra River, and worked with both William Thomas and later John Green, who we saw in one of Auntie Joy's slides, to make the small farming community at Corranderk a success. At its peak in 1870, the settlement comprised 32 cottages, 5 other buildings, 300 hectares of fence grazing land, and with a further 60 hectares under cultivation. However, by 1875, the Central Board for the Protection of Aborigines had dismissed Green and appointed a succession of bad managers. This was also the year that Barak became Narangita for the Kulin after the death of Bilibilari's son, Simon Wonga. Over the next 7 years, Barak fought against a concerted proposal by greedy colonists to remove Corranderk to a less desirable, i.e. less fertile and productive site. Through the diplomacy and network of influential connections, Barak was successful in lobbying for a board of inquiry to investigate continuing problems at Corranderk. This resulted in its gazetting in 1884 as a permanent reserve, revocable only by an Act of Parliament. Barak would have first met Howitt in 1877, when Howitt was appointed as a member of the 1877 Royal Commission into the Corranderk Station. Twice in the early 1880s, first in 1882 and then again in 1884, Barak journeyed to Gippsland on Howitt's invitation and expense so that he could be questioned about the customs of tribes from the Melbourne area. Their first encounter produced 73 foolscap pages of notes, now in the National Museum of Victoria, and the second visit included Barak's attendance at the initiation ceremony sponsored by Howitt for the Kearney people at Lake Victoria. Barak's legendary skills as a communicator, and importantly as a cross-cultural communicator, are strongly illustrated by this important object, now in the museum's National Historical Collection. It is a handwritten illuminated address to former Victorian Premier Graham Berry. In March 1886, a group of Kulin men, led by Barak, travelled to Melbourne, probably walked, to farewell Berry, who was returning to England. Along with gifts of spears, boomerangs and other artefacts, they presented this illuminated address, which they obviously considered was the proper form of thanks to Berry for his assistance in keeping Corranderk Station against the advice of the Aboriginal Protection Board. As Jonathan Jones, who's working with me at the moment on a project in the southeast, has suggested to me about Barak and other 19th century Aboriginal people, they had to become explorers, really, in their own country, working out the best ways to survive in the new world that had been thrust upon them, a world in which their rights, especially their rights to land and natural resources, were no longer acknowledged. This is taking the prism of history and turning it in a way to shed new light on what happened. Barak and other Aboriginal leaders of the time were not just reacting to the European present, but was actively working strategically to make the best that they could of their changed circumstances. This illuminated dress and the beautiful drawings made by Barak, both as presents and for sale, are testimony to this view. Oh, I'm not good at this thing. Now, these are... seem to have got my... my pages mixed up there. Before we can move to discussing Barak's highly original drawing, it's useful to consider the relationship of his drawings to the traditional art of the time and cultural area. The figurative and schematic dimensions of Barak's drawings combine with the patterns, colours and shapes to reveal a consistency with the engravings on wooden objects such as shields and clubs. The contemporary narrative art of bark drawings, with its concern to record and perhaps relate specific notable events, seems also to have been common in the southeast, including Tasmania, in early contact times, or from when people were collecting material. However, the bark charcoal drawings were highly perishable, and like other bark art from the southeast, few have survived in collections today. Here are the line drawings of the three extant examples, and from left to right, they're the Lake Tyrrell bark, obtained before 1874 and now in Museum Victoria, and two earlier barks from the Loddon River, both collected by pastoralist John Hunter Kerr and exhibited at Sandhurst, which the old name for Bendigo, in 1854, before being forwarded to the International Exhibition held in Paris in 1855, and now in the collections of Kew Gardens and the British Museum, respectively. And this last one, which I won't dwell on too much, is a sketch by the Chief Protector George Augustus Robinson of a bark drawing which he saw in the Loddon, in a hut on the Loddon River in 1843, and it's now in the State Library of New South Wales. And on this trip, Robinson had come across several abandoned campsites with huts containing drawings scratched into the blackened inner bark. The first he saw was of humans and drays, possibly a representation of Major Mitchell, who had passed through the area in 1836, the marks of his dray, the major's line, being visible for many years. Robinson also records drawings containing at least 90 figures of men and emus dancing and gives a sketch of a striking, if worrying, representation of a white man, indicated by the hat. And the quote from Robinson is, "He was pierced through with spears, some throwing, others picking them up. There were men, women and children." So now I want to discuss the meanings behind some of Barak's drawings. The subjects of the subject of this drawing, which was collected by the Reverend Friedrich Hagener, portray all the aspects of traditional culture that he most feared, such as ceremonies and fighting. Hagener was against Aboriginal people at his station sort of engaging with what he thought were traditional activities in any way. And this drawing appears to contain at least 3 to 4 different scenes. In the central area, a large figure is bent backwards, his body pierced by 3 separate spears. To his front, a large cloaked figure accompanied by a small dog stands under a tree, while in the background, somebody is running away. To the left is a group of 4 cloaked women holding small babies to their chests, and above them is a procession of 11 cloaked men, their traditional bags strung over their shoulders. The drawing is completed by another 3 figures set at right angles to the main composition. They are warriors brandishing broad shields and spear throwers. They appear to be running through the trees, their cloaks flying open behind them. And here, in fact, were Hagener's worst fears about corroborees, I think, realised that they in his terms, led to fights and presumably about women. But this drawing is obviously a narrative. It's more than just shapes and people on a canvas. Barak must have used it to illustrate a real story, either an event he witnessed or a story he had been told. 100 years later, after the events have been recounted, it's difficult to ascribe this particular narrative to one drawing. But there is one that to one story, but there is one that fits, and it's written up in the section of the Native Tribes of Southeast Australia that deals with marriage rules. This particular story was one which Barak remembered from, quote, the time he was a boy without whiskers, or before the European settlement of Port Phillip. It happened near Benalla when an old man of the Kulin tribe took revenge on his son for stealing a young woman who was in relationship of sister to him. The old man got very angry and said, quote, I'm ashamed, everyone will hear of this. Why have you done this thing? I have done with you altogether, at which point he speared his son, who died soon after. The account goes on to describe how there were lots of fighting activities within the Kulin nation over women when people on both sides met and fought. The above is not necessarily exactly the same story as drawn by Barak in the Hernhut picture where that drawing currently resides, but it provides a convincing explanation of how narrative might work in Barak's art, just as in some of the earlier Bach drawings that we saw. And although these interpretations are to some extent supposition, there are many other examples in Barak's oeuvre which appear to be convincing narratives. This is certainly the case with the four Barak drawings in the Ethnographic Museum at Berlin, in Berlin, which were collected by German ethnographer Arthur Bessler in the 1890s, collected from Australia when he visited Korenduk. One of these, Ceremony 1880s, displays a complex composition. It appears to have between 4 to 5 related vignettes, including a row of cloaked women, a row of dancing men holding clubs, a set of energetic warriors dancing with boomerangs, 2 ceremonial leaders, seated clapping women, a wombat and echidna, and most extraordinary of all is the group of stylized women standing at the front of the drawing, wearing elaborate headdresses and intricately patterned cloaks. The lead woman is also holding 2 barbed spears. Maybe see that a bit clearer. Who can say today what story is being recounted in this drawing? However, I was immediately reminded of one that William Thomas had told to Robert Brough Smythe, author of the 2-volumed Aborigines of Victoria, 1878, which related to members of the Aboriginal police and an incident that had occurred on the 12th of December, 1845. It was a story in which a group of women was featured, and indeed this was the arresting singularity. And the story goes, and again, it was a story that was recounted, at the time, not by Barak in this instance, but it was something that was being talked about by William Thomas. 3 of the police, which possibly included Barak, who was in the native police at the time, so he may have actually either witnessed this event or heard the stories about it, were all camped with William Thomas when they woke suddenly one morning and said that they had the disease called Turan. They thought that thin twigs of she-oak had been thrust into their eyes by sorcerers, and they despaired. And the quote then goes on, dismay spread through the people, and there was great confusion in the encampment. But then a group of female doctors approached, and that's female sort of, clever women, really. And after a variety of practices, including the repetition of strange songs and wild notes of sorrow and defiance, the patients recovered and return to their usual duties. Another striking Barak drawing in Berlin appears to be equally complex with layers of stories, but I suggest it actually recounts a well-documented tale. In all the stories that Barak recorded for Howitt, there does not appear to be any subject that occasions a journey. And I'm thinking of the bottom 2 rows of the Barak drawing there, in association with a celebration in the upper rows at the top of the scene. However, such an event did in fact occur and was recorded by later staged photographs. This was in December 1862, when the Kulin families began their long walk from the old Acheron Station to their promised land, the camping place of the Wurundjeri, where Badgers Creek joined the Yarra River. This was the site of the new Aboriginal station that became known as Corranderk. This drawing could very well retell this momentous event. In the lower half of the drawing, we see the Kulin men and women on the march. The bearded men are loaded with their traditional possessions, such as spears, spear throwers, and kangaroo skin bags, while the women lead the way forward, leaning on the digging sticks, their own bags slung over their shoulders. The upper part of the drawing depicts the celebration when they arrived. A corroboree is underway, and the men dance in triumph, while the seated women make music. The three deep-rooted trees that frame the scene represent the bountiful country of their new home at Corranderk. Oh. That's bad. That means 1 minute. Oh, okay. Remarkably, the photographer Giles Walter staged this exact scene for the benefit of his camera in the mid-1860s. The resulting photograph describes the same event, the walk from the Acheron with the men balancing their guns and their bedrolls, led by Simon Wonga and the Reverend John Green in the centre, and the women glimpsed walking in parallel but behind them. The perspective of the barrack drawing is sadly lacking. The previous photo is often paired with another image by Charles Walter titled Open Air Service in Bush Setting. It shows John Green holding an open air service at Corranderk a couple of months after their arrival. It is possible to see this photograph as the visual or mental counterpart for the upper half of the barracks Berlin drawing. It is strikingly similar, with the men standing, Bibles in hand, and the women sitting, singing under the trees. Maybe there's not quite the same sense of joy as in the barrack drawing. Perhaps it was Barak, John Green's first true convert to Christianity at Corranderk, who suggested the photographs be taken, which later then provided inspiration for his drawing. So I'm going to have to miss the very famous drawing, I think, of the quarry site. I won't have time for that, but there it is, very quickly, from the National Gallery's collection. In conclusion, I hope that you will agree that barracks drawings are so much more than groups of similar schema which tell a repeated corroboree fighting or hunting story. As I recounted at the beginning of this presentation, Judith Ryan has commented that an extraordinary feature of barracks' works is how his compositions dominate all of the pictorial space. They are not just some exotic spectacle, but an inclusive Aboriginal perspective, as if from inside the event. I believe my approach of trying to match Barak's words to his drawings has helped to confirm this very perceptive comment. With historical research and a detailed examination of his drawings, their storytelling intent can be clearly recognised. It was Barak's genius as a great Aboriginal leader and communicator that his drawings have continued to gain in admiration, respect and value as unique narratives which he used to illustrate elements of his beloved Wurundjeri or wider Kulin culture. Thank you. Sorry.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.